Today on Against the Grain. It's indisputably one of the most important works in history. Karl Marx's Capital has been perennially embraced by those trying to understand and move beyond the capitalist system, and reviled in equal measure by those defending the established order. Yet until now, English readers of the first volume of Marx's magnum opus have not had access to the authoritative final version edited and approved by Marx himself. Paul Reiter and Paul North discuss their new translation based on the last German edition of Capital. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's been frequently noted that the world of capitalism that Marx described presciently has never been so fully realized than in our decades of global economic turbulence and precarity. Marx aimed to describe the inner workings of capitalism in a multi-volume series, Capital, of which only the first volume was published in his lifetime. While Capital was translated into English for the first time in 1887 and twice after, no editions have been based on the final version of Capital that Marx revised and improved for publication. That, however, has been rectified by a new translation by Paul Reiter, which is co-edited by Paul North. Reiter is professor of Germanic languages and literatures at Ohio State University, while North is professor of German at Yale. Several months ago, I had the opportunity to talk with both of them about this new work. We're airing the full conversation for the first time. So the first volume of Marx's Capital has not seen a new English translation in 50 years since the translation published by Penguin in 1976, which I'm guessing is what most of us who have read Capital have read. The Penguin translation of Capital followed the third major global crisis of the capitalist system in the early 1970s, and your translation, and you note a whole number of translations into other languages, follows the fourth global crisis of capitalism. Is that a coincidence, or do you think that the times in which we live have made this work seem especially relevant?
As with all cultural historical questions, I guess you have to say there's multiple factors. The crisis of 2008 is one factor. The faltering and failure of neoliberalism, first the apparent success of neoliberalism and the distress it caused for workers on people's bank accounts politically all across the world, causes you to look for explanations. And this book is still the most coherent, the most incisive explanation for all of those phenomena. So it's really interesting, the history of reading Capital Volume 1. It's been read steadily since it came out. It came out to a kind of hushed reception, except for the stalwarts and some people who knew what was there. But very soon it became the leading text, giving workers the terms exploitation, surplus value, giving workers the impetus to fight back. Chapter 8 in this version talks all about the successes of workers' movements in rolling back really heinous 19th century conditions, like very long work days, children in the workplace, etc. But there are peaks and troughs of the reading, and when things become desperate, people take desperate measures, and reading Capital, a very, very hard book, is a kind of desperate measure.
Clearly translating Capital again is a huge undertaking. Paul Reiter, why did you believe that a new translation was warranted? This one based on that earlier translation I mentioned on the second German edition of Capital.
There's an old saying that a classic should be translated anew every 50 years or so. And while I don't necessarily agree with what I think is the thinking behind that idea, which is that translations don't age that well, there are lots of translations that become classics in their own right, I do think that it makes some sense. You know, what we're interested in, this changes. When you're talking about a work like Capital, the scholarship advances in all kinds of ways that can inform the way a translator approaches the text. And so, to some extent, it really felt like it was time, and that it wasn't necessarily the case that the existing translations were deficient in some obvious way. I think they're competent translations. However, at the same time, having taught the text a number of times using the existing English translations, there were things that I wanted to convey that were important for my reading of the text that didn't come across in those translations, and that was definitely part of the motivation as well.
And we'll come back to this question of translation and what the translation was based on, but before we do that, I wanted to ask you, Paul North, if you could just remind us of the social context in which Marx wrote Capitals, so that obviously you're looking at the form that it took as it's, you know, highly enmeshed with the content. What was the world of his day that he attempted to decipher here in Capital?
One of the things that makes the book so complex to read, but so rewarding, is that it weaves together a lot of those forces or influences, social forces, intellectual possibilities. Marx was writing after Hegel. He was writing after the great political economists, now known as classical political economists, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, and their students and readers. He was writing after the French Revolution. He was writing after the partial liberation of Jews in Germany, which both benefited and caused problems for his family. He was writing at a time when the first industrial revolution was showing its tremendous excesses. That's excesses, not successes. The excesses were chronicled by his friend, who was not yet his friend, Friedrich Engels, whose father was an industrialist, and one of his factories was in Manchester, and he sent his, I believe, 18-year-old son out to learn the business, and Engels entered the factory floor and wrote a book called The Condition of the Working Class in England, which Marx read, and that cemented their friendship, first of all, and it taught Marx that the problem was not political, not primarily political, but was primarily economic. So I would say he had an opportunity, but he took it because of his philosophical training. And that opportunity was to review other people's writings about how capitalism works. He wasn't the first to see it. It wasn't that new. It wasn't new at all. It really got going in earnest in the mid-18th century. And Capital was around since about the 15th century. But the industrial juggernaut had started producing a lot of negative consequences. And the accounts of those negative consequences by political economists, Smith and Ricardo and their people, were what he was criticizing. So he could sort of take the results of the first studies and see where all their flaws were, and that was his method.
Can you describe for us how in Capital Marx sought to, by engaging with the work and also rejecting the work of classical political economists like Adam Smith and David Ricardo, how he used that as a basis for trying to make visible what was hidden or obscured about the inner workings, or maybe more accurately, the processes of the capitalist system?
Yeah, that's really the key question. And he was ingenious in using what they had discovered. And these are immensely rich texts, rich in observation, Smith's Wealth of Nations and Ricardo's Principles of Political Economy, rich in observations, rich in theory. And both of them saw how what they didn't really call the capital system, but was the capital system, had a number of qualities that were different. It had to keep moving. It had to absorb its outside. It had to keep certain of its members, workers, very close to subsistence living. They recognized that. What they didn't really recognize was why. So what Marx could do was take the phenomena they had tracked and really through using more philosophical categories, show how it worked. One way it works, just to say, is through a kind of deceptive but no less necessary appearance. One name for this for Marx is fetishism. A commodity is a fetish, though not in a psychological sense or in the racist sense that European anthropologists use this term to describe African religions or spirituality or ways of living. Marx was being very ironic when he called the commodity a fetish. He was upping the Europeans with their own term to call them animists rather than the people they were disrespecting with the term. This is one of his modes of irony, and Reiter's translation really captures all these ironies in the most visceral way. It's one of the great benefits of this translation. In any case, fetish is a mode of appearance. Some things appear like they're in control. The fact that it seems like your money can command other commodities is an effect of the fetishism of money and the fetishism of commodities. Really, what happens is someone makes the commodities and someone takes the extra money that's made from the producers of those commodities who aren't getting paid for all of their work. And they relate to one another, the buyer and the seller, through things rather than directly. It looks like the things are acting on each other and acting on us. My commodity brings me to market. A commodity draws the money out of me. But this is an appearance that hides the rest of the operation. It isn't false, it's true. This is the way things happen in capital, but it's not the full story. So one thing he shows that classical political economists didn't show was that there is a logic of appearance in capital, and there's a reason we don't see its inner workings.
What does value mean for Marx, and how did he think about or rethink its importance, drawing from, you know, his predecessors, the classical political economists? How is value such a central concept to capital?
Value is really the main thing to be explained in Volume 1. And it continues to be the motivating force in the other volumes. There are two other volumes that have been published. Those need to be read as well, although he didn't finish either one of them. They were finished and produced for publication by his friend Engels after his death. Value is a peculiar thing. It's something you don't see, but you know it's there. It's something that keeps itself intact, even if I trade something to you for something else. The value that I had in that thing, I have again in what I've traded you. He calls it a sensible, super sensible. And this, I would say, for Marx, is the quasi-metaphysics of capitalism. It trades in these invisible things that nonetheless rule our lives. Value doesn't exist on its own. It doesn't float around like a spirit. It exists only in commodities. But it is what we know we're getting when we do trades. He spends a lot of time in the first chapters, which, by the way, are the hardest, explaining how value works. Another interesting aspect of value under the capital system is that it has to keep in motion. And that is what makes the lives of people who live under the capital system. And it's important to say both workers and owners, both the capitalists and the ones who don't have capital, they're all pushed along to keep value moving, because if it stops moving, the system collapses. That's called a crisis.
Where does that term capital, obviously the title of this book, come from? And how does Marx use it? Because as you emphasize in your introductions to the book, Marx did not write about objects fixed in space. He wrote about processes. How is capital understood by Marx?
Yeah, capital is even weirder than value. Part of his purpose in writing this book was to make the things we take for granted but are only half conscious of both conscious and strange. And you start to look into value and capital and you realize how strange they really are. Value is something that's only worth it if you don't have the thing to use. If you don't want to use the thing, you have its value. If you use the thing, you don't have its value anymore. Marx calls that a contradiction. And capital is even weirder in the sense that the immediate definition of capital is, this is the theoretical explanation of capital, value that valorizes itself. Value that makes more value out of what seems to be the same. In other words, it's impossible. The book is really about explaining where the more of value comes from. And if you've read the book, you know it comes from extra labor of laborers who don't get paid for that part of their working time. Capital as a phenomenon in history. So the book is really about the theory of capital, although he brings in the history of the formation of the capital system at different places. In fact, the final chapters of the book talk about the bloody history in which violence is used to install capital where other systems were installed. And you can still see that today in zones of the world in which imperialism and colonialism are pushing people out of traditional practices and making their resources or their labor viable for capitalism. But just to say briefly the history, capital is the name for money that makes more money that is invested and is supposed to bring a return bigger than the investment. And it started to be a financial technique in the 15th century for getting money across to a colony or to a faraway place from Europe to do some work over there. Why would a European do it if they got something more back? One way to get something back, giving money overseas, is to trade and get something back you need. But there was extra capital, extra money that became capital when it went away and brought something back. And that was one of the elements expanded and only became so aggravatingly accumulative once the capital system became industrialized in the 18th century. Earlier, three centuries earlier, it was simply a technique to do something financially in a very limited way.
That's the voice of Paul North. He's co-editor of a new edition and translation of Marx's Capital, along with my other guest, Paul Reiter, who is the translator of the book. It is published by Princeton University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Paul Reiter, your co-editor was describing a world of capitalism as Marx understood it, in which what is real is often invisible, and also so much of the processes of capitalism are multiple. These are not things flat and simple for us to look at and figure out. And I wanted to ask you, how did Marx struggle to find the right form and vocabulary for his project of understanding these inner workings of capital and of capitalism?
Well, he had some serious challenges of representation on his hands. So one of his ideas about value under capitalism is that it's a social thing, not a physical thing. And as you suggested, there's a lot of doubling in this book. A commodity is a double thing. It's one thing and the opposite of that thing. It's a use value, a physical thing that meets a want or need, and it's also a value thing, a hunk of objectified, abstract human labor. But another big point here is that value acts like a natural thing, and this is why people tend to view it as a natural thing rather than a social thing, which is part of the fetishism of commodities. And so to play up that part of value, Marx describes this non-physical thing in very physical terms, such as a gelatinous blob of undifferentiated human labor. That's one of his terms for value. He also talks about it as a Gegenständlichkeit, and this word had been translated as objectivity. It had also been translated just as reality, but really what it means here is something like objecthood. Marx wants to play up that this is a non-physical thing that acts like a physical thing, that acts like an actual object. And so at one point, he speaks of a ghostly objecthood, having recourse to a frankly oxymoronic statement to try to get at what it is he's talking about. And he changed this terminology quite a bit from the first edition of Capital Volume 1 to the second edition of Capital Volume 1. The first edition appeared in 1867, the second edition, 1872. The second edition is the basis for our translation. That's our source text. And he didn't always make his terminology consistent. So there's some terminology from the older edition that wasn't revised as it might have been. So that's another challenge in reading Capital.
And how is that for you in the process of translating the book? I mean, you note that Marx made up words to fit his purposes. Marx drew on all sorts of different techniques to try and convey this multiple system, this contradictory system. What sort of position does that put the translator in trying to make sense of this for an English-speaking audience?
There are a lot of striking lines where Marx talks about value, about surplus value. He likens the formation of surplus value to the logic of the Trinity, where the Father is only the Father because of the Son, but the Father and the Son are one and the same. So capital is only capital because it's going to throw off surplus capital, but the surplus capital and the capital are actually one and the same, like the Father and the Son. So some of this was a lot of fun to translate and to see if, you know, I could set things up so that it lands kind of like it lands in the German. Marx is very funny. I mean, I think this is funny, and he sets up his punchlines, a lot of them having to do with religion, which he never tires of making fun of. He sets them up very deliberately and carefully, and so some of the pleasure of translating this book was trying to do that, but there were definitely challenges around this neologistic language of value, one of them being that in German it's a lot easier to build compound nouns than it is in English. They stand out a lot more in English than they do in German, and so I had to decide whether I wanted to just follow the German and use a compound noun in English, or whether the compound noun status wasn't so important because the word is going to bring a lot more attention to itself in English than its counterpart in German. Another challenge that I talk about in the translator's preface is that German compared with English is very personifying language. There are verbs paired with inanimate things that don't usually go with inanimate things in English. Reflexive verbs are used with inanimate things all the time, so that if you're translating very directly from German to English, you're going to wind up saying things like, well, the question raises itself, that you can sort of say in English, but it sounds very unnatural. In German, it's an everyday formulation. One challenge, then, in this book where Marx does a lot of programmatic personification and has capital doing things that inanimate things generally don't do, and by the way, the other translations actually pretty frequently change Marx's capital to capitalist because of this. I don't do that, where Marx has capital doing something that you would expect a person to do. I have capital doing that thing. But it can be hard to know whether you have a case of Marx being Marx or German being German. And I wanted to be very careful with the personification, because if you just generally follow the German and you have a translation where there's a lot more personification than there is in English, because, again, of this difference between English and German, then those really important moments of personification are just going to seem like more indiscriminate foreignizing in a translation that's just generally creating an English that kind of sounds like German. And I wanted those programmatic moments of personification to come across. So this was something that I really spent a lot of time thinking about, going over, and, you know, it has to do with the way Marx treats value. As Paul calls it, a quasi-metaphysical thing. It is, as he said in talking about the fetishism aspect of this, it is something that has a kind of control over people. One of the ironies of modern capitalist society, which sees itself as such a modern thing, is that, in a way, it's a fetishistic world where inanimate things have a certain power over people. They have created these things that they don't understand, commodities, and then they just, you know, hope that the market kind of goes their way, but they don't really have the sense that the movement of the market, the movement of commodities in the market, is under their control. And Marx plays this up, and one way he does this is, again, through a personifying language.
Paul Reuter, Capital is obviously not just one of the most important political texts, but it's also regarded as a major literary work. And I wanted to ask you how you would characterize the literary style of Capital. Yours is the fourth translation into English of Capital, and whether you feel like that style comes through in the other translations, because I would imagine that given the political stakes for many of the people translating Marx, often the emphasis would be on getting sort of fealty to the sentiment, the political sentiment, not necessarily to whatever sort of stylistic flourish that Marx was making.
So the first translation, which was overseen by Engels, caused Engels a lot of pain. Engels was very much a purist in matters of Marx translation, and he complained a lot over the years about the inadequacies of Marx translations. And he complained somewhat bitterly to Marx, who was involved in the French translation of Capital, that Marx himself suggested had simplifying tendencies about these tendencies. But then, when it came time for him to oversee the first English translation of Capital, he really does seem to have gone against some of his own translation principles and focused on a translation that didn't ask too much of readers, that in a way pulls back on the strangeness of the text. A lot of these neologisms that we were just talking about, terms that are strange in German, like Gegenständlichkeit or Wertgegenständlichkeit, these are translated in that first translation, again overseen by Engels, as very everyday words, like as value, for example. And you have to keep in mind that first translations, they have particular pressures. Marx was not very well known in 1887 when the first English translation came out. And so you didn't have a base of motivated readers as you have today, where people think, okay, this is going to be difficult, we know, but it's a classic, it's worth it, it's an important book, so we're going to steel ourselves for this difficulty. Engels had to worry about people giving up pretty quickly. And so that is a translation that does prioritize a certain kind of readability, I would say, a readability that is won through making the text less strange than it is in English. The second translation, its goal was to be even more accessible than the first translation. This was done in 1928, after the Russian Revolution. The idea was that, well, Marx, his ideas are so important now in the world, we should have an even more accessible translation. That was the goal there. That translation didn't really go anywhere. It was criticized quite harshly by the most important scholar of Marx at the time, a person named David Ryazanov, and it never really recovered from that judgment. The Fowkes translation from 1976 is interesting. Fowkes complains about, he doesn't mention the second translation by Eden and Cedar Paul. He just talks in his preface about the Samuel Moore, Edward Aveling, original 1887 translation. And he says that it prioritized accessibility above all else, and it watered down Marx's philosophical terminology, but it also failed to preserve the literary qualities of Marx's language. And his goal then, clearly, is to do better on both fronts. Does he do that? Well, in some ways, it's a more technical-sounding translation. He does go farther in preserving Marx's neologistic conceptual vocabulary than Moore Aveling do, but not as far as you might expect. In fact, he follows them in quite a few places and gives paraphrases rather than individual terms for some of Marx's neologistic concepts around value. He also follows them quite a bit elsewhere too. So his translation is not quite as different from theirs as he perhaps makes it out to be, although it is, generally speaking, a more technical-sounding translation that does do a lot of noun-to-noun translating, which it has its, that has its advantages. It's a way of conveying something about the structure of the German text, but it's not the best way to preserve some of what I understand to be the literary qualities of the work. Rhythm, cadence, these things were very important to Marx. The shifts in register, moving from technical discussions to jokes. Marx also uses very sophisticated mimetic techniques in this book, which is something that I only really came to appreciate when I was doing this translation. He imitates people from the third person so that he can comment on what they're saying, what he's having them say, capitalists, political economists, without interrupting their monologue. And I think it works really well, and it's not something that I've seen a lot of. And I would say that this is a very sophisticated literary device. Also, the way he quotes is, there's definitely an artistry to that. Not only literary quotations, where he kind of reworks the quotations creatively to fit his purposes. He was someone who had a very intimate knowledge of high culture and a great deal of respect for high culture, but not a reverential attitude toward it. He didn't mind getting in there and changing around quotations by Goethe, for example, to fit his purposes, but also the way he arranges quotations from factory inspectors' reports. It's really a very impressive thing that he does.
Well, perhaps this is an out-of-her question, because maybe you're too close to the text to be able to answer this, but given what you've said, the difference in, it sounds like, the nuances that come through with choices to translate Marx's Capital the way you have versus the previous translations, would you say that the net result of it has just added to the complexity of the text, or would you say that there are some places where certain concepts, if we were to step back, seem to come to the fore more?
Certainly when you translate compound nouns in German as compound nouns in English, they tend to draw a little more attention to themselves, because this building of compound nouns in German is just done more widely, famously so. This is, I suppose, what we mean when we say, oh, there's got to be a German word for that. You have this ability to just stick words together and create nouns. So, for example, the term in German that I translate as value thing, wert Ding, it's a kind of a neologism or a near neologism, but I think that it sounds a bit stranger in English than it does in German, value thing with a hyphen. So I think that that then stands out much more than how it was translated in the other translations, which I think it's translated there at times as object of value. It's translated inconsistently at times as a thing possessing value, which frankly I think is a somewhat misleading translation, because a thing possessing value is basically a commodity. That's what a commodity is, a thing that also has a value component. Whereas with value thing, Marx is talking about the value part of the commodity. the thing possessing value. In other words, the non-physical part of that physical thing that consists of objectified abstract human labor, this social substance, as he puts it.
I'm speaking with Paul Ryder and Paul North. Together, they are co-editors of a new edition and translation of Marx's Capital, the first volume which Paul Ryder translated. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, staying for a moment more with the particulars of the translation, obviously for people on the left, what Marx actually meant is an area of debate and discussion, and one area that has in recent decades been considered again is around the notion of the kind of bloody dispossession that Paul North mentioned earlier, which had been translated as primitive accumulation, the process of enclosing land, dispossessing people who are then forced to become waged workers, that this is a crucial process in the history of capitalism. And there are those like David Harvey who would argue, or the people in the Midnight Notes Collective, Peter Linebaugh and Silvia Federici, that this is a process that doesn't just happen at the dawn of capitalism, but happens again and again. And hence, the way these things are conceived of has some relevance to such debates. And I wanted to ask you about that term primitive accumulation, which I think raises the hackles of a lot of people. Just the term primitive is obviously very uneasy terminology in the first place, but how you handled that translation and whatever challenges it posed.
I should say that there was a lot of collaboration in this translation process, for collaboration between me and Paul, and we talked about these terms that I've been mentioning, the vocabulary around value, quite a bit, going back and forth. Paul pushed back on a lot of my decisions and was very heavily involved in these translation decisions. And he was the one who wrote the footnote on original accumulation and explaining the translation decision there. And so he's probably better equipped than I am to answer this question.
Paul North, how did you come to terms with the term which has, in previous versions of Marx's Capital, been translated as primitive accumulation?
One thing that never ceases to amaze me is how many really bloody battles there are among readers of Marx about what he means. It pales in comparison to the bloody dispossession of agricultural workers leading up to industrialization, but it's pretty astounding. That's because these are complicated issues. And I would just say that what's being fought over there is capital's outside. It's very hard to even understand your own experience when you're living in a capital system. What are your motivations? Are they your own? Are they your own psychological motivations, your private motivations, or are they given to you through advertising or given to you through the form of employment that you have? It's hard to understand it from there, but people are constantly looking where the outside is. And Marx made the argument that capital absorbs its outside in violent ways. That happens in a number of ways. It happens in reproductive labor, people who are doing labor in the home, for example, traditionally women, but now often immigrants, who don't get recompense. Capital uses it, but in a sense is extracting it without being involved in the capital process of having to pay a wage. And so there's many, many places in which capital is absorbing its outside in ways that are not recompensed. And in fact, the first person who took issue with the idea that original accumulation, in German, ursprüngliche Akkumulation, was still going on under capital. It didn't just precede capital. Was Rosa Luxemburg, a great theorist from the early 20th century, a great reader of Marx, a critic of Marx, and Federici and that group is really in the inheritance of Rosa Luxemburg. why should we call it original accumulation rather than primitive accumulation? Well, primitive has all those connotations of being naive, of being developmentally backwards, of being simple in some way. And this form of accumulation is none of those things. When land was appropriated for capitalist use without recompense by sovereigns, and the workers on it, the peasants on it, were dispossessed, kicked out, and they had to go become wage workers, this was not simple. It also was developmentally exactly where it needed to be in history. So primitive is just wrong, and most readers understand that that has too many bad implications. Original is also wrong, and Marx uses it in quotation marks or with the term so-called in front of it, because in fact, original is the way the political economists call it. In fact, it's not original, it's ongoing and forever that capital will be absorbing its outside and violent ways. So the irony, when you translate it as original, the irony comes back. When you strip off those false associations of primitive, you get the irony back, which is, well, it's not fully capitalist, but capitalism uses those not fully capitalist ways of accumulating things continuously.
Why is it that you decided, both of you decided, to base this new edition and this new translation that Paul Reiter did on the second German edition of Capital that Marx published? And what is the significance of the French translation of Capital from the early 1870s, which you also reference in this project?
So the first thing to understand is that Marx was writing continually. In fact, an argument has been made that this version of Volume 1 of Capital is 1/72nd of all the manuscripts he produced for the Capital Project. That's not including his earlier writings. So it's a little falsifying to choose a text and just present it, because he changed his mind, he revised, he kept making notes for revisions on important concepts, and then also revisions that had to do with how those concepts were presented so that the people he wanted to read this, who were the workers, could have the most access to it. So he was constantly revising. And for that reason, there's a number of versions. The second German edition, which came out in 1872, is the most trustworthy. It is its own edition. It's the most trustworthy in one sense because Marx saw it through to publication. Every change in it was his. And it is substantially in its intellectual content the same as all the other versions, including the French edition. Everything that's in the second edition, except for a few very small exceptions, are in the French. And the third and fourth editions were re-edited by Engels after Marx's death to include some other changes, some from the French translation, which Marx oversaw. This manuscript history and version history is really complicated. I think I only finally understand it now after a decade. And some from notes he made towards his own third edition. That is to say, there were changes after the second edition. It's debated which ones of them are really useful. The ones we find very useful and have been signaled by scholars, we include in an appendix, including from the French translation. We also include an essay about the changes in the French translation in the after material to this volume. But this way you can see what Marx settled as a final version for the second edition and what he might have added. The other translations are from the third and fourth editions where Engels made changes and sometimes signals them and sometimes doesn't. And as you're reading, you really can't tell what is Marx's and what's added. And the problem there is that Engels was a very good reader of Marx. But even he didn't know, probably Marx didn't know, until he went and actually did a third edition, which of the changes he had thought of he would have used and which he would have decided were not necessary or were leading in wrong directions. There is no perfect solution to this. The best solution would be to have our translation or Paul's translation of the second edition, a translation of the French translation into English, and then a translation of the first edition, which has some substantial differences from the second edition and is not fully available in English.
While Capital has become synonymous with the first volume, which is what Paul Reiter has translated and you together have edited, it was never meant to be a standalone work to explain all of capitalism. What was left of the other two volumes of a project that was meant to be six volumes and ended up intending to be four volumes? And what do you make of the translation of those?
I applaud your knowledge of the Capital Project. It's not the easiest thing to keep track of because it changed a number of times, Marx's designs for this project. But as you say, Capital One, people treat as sometimes the whole thing. So Capital One is sometimes made out to be the whole project. It's not. There are two other volumes, both of them published after Marx's death, edited by Engels. The chronology is interesting. Marx wrote the third volume first, 1864, 1865. Then Volume One, the only one that was published during his lifetime, was published, the first edition of it was published in 1867. And then he got to work more seriously on Volume Two and produced one of the main manuscripts for Volume Two in 1868, 1869. But there are actually eight manuscripts that Engels used as the basis for Volume Two. They were written over about 15 years. And so you can say that Volume Two is Marx's last word on Capital, the last manuscript that was used as part of the basis for Volume Two was written in 1881 or finished in 1881, although none of these manuscripts was actually really finished. They're all incomplete manuscripts. And so Volume Two is, or was for Engels, the biggest editing challenge. It would be the biggest philological challenge for somebody trying to do a new edition of it. The translation, the existing English translation of Volume Two, came out long before the German critical edition of Capital had made available all of those eight manuscripts, which allows you to track Engels's interventions and to make transparent for readers all that Engels did to produce a volume that seemed like a finished, stylistically and conceptually integrated volume out of these manuscripts that were written over a period of 15 years, during which Marx's thought changed quite a bit. And so we are getting to work on Volume Two, and this is one of the big philological challenges that we're facing there. We're going to use Engels's edition, but we want to make transparent to readers the editing process. And this is not to criticize Engels's editing process, just to say that we think it's important for readers to be able to see how it was that this work came about out of these various unfinished manuscripts. We try, by the way, in our edition of Volume One to make things as transparent as possible for the reader there too. This involves letting the reader know when Marx has altered his source material in some way. I said that Marx was a creative quoter. Well, one of the ways that he was creative in quoting was to rearrange quotations a little bit, although there's some significant, and we think, very interesting challenges here as well, because a lot of the material that Marx cites in Capital Volume One, it was originally written in English, and he's citing this material in his own translations. And so it can be difficult to know whether Marx is translating in a freewheeling, somewhat aggressive way, that was his own translating style, or whether he has redone the quotation a little bit to fit his purposes. And the existing translations, they don't make any of this transparent. Sometimes they just give what's in the the source material, and they don't worry about the difference between what Marx gives his reader in the German edition and what's in the source material. And sometimes they follow what Marx does in his version of the source material, but they don't tell the reader necessarily that there's a deviation between what's in the actual source material and what's in Marx's version of it. And we're try to allow readers to see what is going on there, where there are shifts that or changes that we think have an important effect on the meaning there.
Jump in, Paul.
Well, I just want to encourage people to read volume 2 and 3. You can wait for our version of volumes 2, but they're really amazing new views of the same system. And it turns out Marx knew this from the beginning. He started from the commodity and he started talking about production, where labor is done on natural objects to make worked objects that can be used socially, and where value is created. But volume 2 talks about the interlocking circulation system, where time and space are stretched and compressed in different ways in order for things to be traded around so that value could be realized. Volume 3, so volume 2 is about the circulation system. Volume 3 is about the system as a whole, and particular how profit is affected by other forces, by competition, and by the movement of resources between different sectors of an economy. So it's a very far away view, complicated, not nearly as fun as volume 1. Volume 1 has monsters and vampires and workers suffering and capitalists bloviating. And volume 3 has a lot of tables. But you can't really understand where profit comes from until you get to volume 3. In fact, volume 1 is really just part of the picture. That's something that's been brought home by a lot of readers and scholars on Marx over the past 30 to 50 years. You must get to volume 3.
Paul North, Paul Ryder, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much. Really a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for your interest in this project.
I've been speaking with the co-editors of a new translation of Marx's Capital, Volume 1, The Critique of Political Economy. Paul Ryder, who translated the book, is professor of Germanic languages and literature at Ohio State University. Paul North is professor of German at Yale University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.